I'm going to be speaking today on the subject, suffering leads to glory. Suffering leads to glory. From Mark chapter 8, verses 27 to 38. If you want to have a Bible and you haven't got one, I'm sure Martin at the back will be glad to give you one to stick your hands in the air. Realization. Verses 27 to 30. I feel quite privileged this morning to have been given such a subject as this. We've been studying Mark for some months, and we've got about halfway through the book. And Mark begins to lead us to a crunch time, because he begins to ask the question through Jesus exactly what he's trying to say throughout his book. And he asks it to his disciples to try and figure out their response. But in some ways it's the theme that has been going all the way through Mark, implicitly. He's been effectively asking the question to those who he encounters, who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? And he's been judging their response, because the two are linked together. We can't ask the question, who is Jesus, and then on the other hand do nothing about it. The two are tied together. If Jesus is who he claims to be, then it requires some action on our part. So it's a really important question as we get to this point of the book. Who is Jesus really? And when we've discovered the answer to that, what are we going to do about it? And on the face of it, Jesus asks a really stupid question. Who do people say that I am? If you ask me the question, or if I ask you the question, who am I? Some of you may not know the answer to that, but most of you would say, well, you're David. You're David McCann. That's who I am. Others of you, being my family, might have a slightly different answer. But in the end, the disciples knew who Jesus was, and so did the people around him. They might have known of his birth in Bethlehem, even if that be a little unexpected. They may not have known about his trip to Egypt and then coming back to Nazareth, but they certainly knew him as the man, Jesus, who lived in Nazareth, in Israel. That's who they would have known him as. So to ask the question, who do people say that I am, seems a bit silly. And yet what we've got to understand is that identity is different from authority. What your name is different from what you represent, what power you have. And Jesus wants us to understand the difference between who is Jesus by name and who is Jesus by authority. And we're quite comfortable with this idea in our culture. For those who can see the screen, who is on the screen? The Queen. Already, you've not given her identity. She is not the Queen by identity. Who is she? She's Elizabeth. Elizabeth Windsor. That is who she is. But you didn't answer the question with who she was. You answered the question with, what is her authority? She is Queen of the United Kingdom. That is her authority. And that gives her certain powers. That's what she has. And the way we treat her is different based on her authority. If the Queen tells you to bow down on your knees, you're probably going to do it. If I tell you to bow down on your knees, I'd be lucky if my children did it, let alone anyone else. David Cameron. That is his identity. But that is not generally how we know his authority. David Cameron is Prime Minister. I'm not actually sure what sort of rights that gives him to our lives, but we certainly recognise him as someone who has authority in this country. He has the highest political power that our country can give, except for perhaps the Queen. Here is a completely different role. Can anyone identify who's on the screen? What is his identity? Alex Ferguson is his identity. What makes him different from a Joe Bloggs on the street? What is his authority? He's the manager of Manchester United Football Club. That does not give him authority over me. But it does give him authority over his players. If he says to his players, you go run to the other end of the pitch and come back again, they do it. Because they know that if they don't do it, there is an associated cost. They're probably not going to be going to play the game the next Saturday or Sunday if they don't do what the manager says. Because they know that he has the authority to say yes or no. He picks the team. Here's a more fictional character. Jean-Luc Picard of the Starship Enterprise. He's the captain of the ship. And everyone recognises that. And he coins the phrase, make it so. If Jean-Luc says to do it, you do it. You make it so. You make every effort to do what he says. There is no other authority on the ship higher than this man. Here's a familiar face. What's his identity? Gordon Curley. And yet he has authority. He's a father. That gives him authority over his children, over his wife. Those who come on Friday night know that Gordon has authority. If he says stop, you stop. If he says go, you go. It's all different levels of authority. Here's Simon Cowell. You may or may not recognise him, but if you watch things like The X Factor and shows like that, you know, he's the one, he's the judge. He says, you're in, you're out. He doesn't give him authority over me, but it does give him authority over those who go on the show. Does anyone recognise this man on the screen? This man has authority. You may not know his authority. You may not even know his identity, but that makes no difference to his authority. Anyone here use Facebook? Let's have a show of hands. Who knows of Facebook? Millions of people use Facebook. This is the man behind it. This is Mark Zuckerberg. The youngest billionaire in the world, 24. He calls the shots on Facebook. What he does has a profound effect on millions of people around the world. But most people don't know his face. They don't know his identity. They may not even know his authority. Anyone recognise this man on the screen? Rupert Murdoch. Once again, he doesn't perhaps look the same sort of vein or has had the same sort of status as the Queen, yet this man has authority over newspapers, over Sky Television and the news. And the way that he reports things in his newspapers affects how we think. You buy a newspaper under his control and he has some authority over you, even if you don't realise it. And so Jesus comes back to this question of, what is my identity? But what, more importantly, what is my authority? Who do you say that I am? What authority do I have over you? And the answer is interesting that the people give him. They actually give the answers of John the Baptist, Elijah, one of the prophets, another of the Gospels talks about Jeremiah. Completely different people, all dead. John the Baptist, the fiery prophet of doom. Elijah, miracle worker, wonder worker, man of prayer. Jeremiah, the heartbroken prophet of love. And yet somehow Jesus was associated with all these sorts of characters. A prophet of doom, prophet of love, miracle worker. And as we look back over Mark, we can see that he has introduced us, Mark, to Jesus' baptism, where it was said, you know, this is my son. We've been introduced to his healings, to his exorcisms of demons, to his preaching, calming the storm, dead people raised back to life, miraculous feeding of thousands of people. These are not ordinary things. But the question is, who is Jesus? What sort of man could do these things? And so he goes on to ask the question, disciples, you've been with me. Who do you say that I am? And maybe it was that Peter was rather surprised by his own answer. Matthew's Gospel says that it was God that gave him this answer. And Peter said, "You are the Christ." The Christ, in New Testament times, was known as God's anointed one. God was going to put his power on someone. There was going to be a deliverer. Someone who was going to free his people, particularly now politically. Because the people of Israel, the Jews, they were under the Roman authority, under the Roman power, and they were looking for someone to rescue them. And Peter says, "You're that man. You are that man. You are the Christ." It was quite a claim. And Jesus says, "I don't want you to spread that around." He doesn't deny it, but he doesn't want them to spread that around. Who do you say Jesus is? Is he the Christ? Because Jesus doesn't want to leave them thinking that's all he is, just the Christ. Were his disciples just glory supporters? We all know about people who support the best football teams. Or at least the ones they believe are going to be the best football teams. We call them glory supporters. They want the glory. They're picking the ones they think are best. I don't know many people that want to pick to be with someone who's a loser. "Please get me go on the losing side." That's not what you often hear. People want to be with those who are going to be doing well, to be successful. We are generally inherently all glory supporters, and the disciples were no less. They saw this man Jesus as one who had the power. One who had the power to overthrow the Romans. And they said, "We're behind you. We're standing with you because we want to be with you when that happens. We're going to be your right hand men. We follow you now, we get the glory later." That's what the disciples were all about. And Jesus says, "That's all very well, but let's move to a different picture." Jesus wants to bring revolution to their thinking. He doesn't want them just to stick with the picture that they had. He wanted to change their perceptions. And so Jesus, for the second time in the book of Mark, uses this phrase, "the Son of Man." I don't know whether you noticed it when I did the reading. The Son of Man. It was also used towards the start of the book, when they'd been picking corn from the cornfields on the Sabbath. And whenever Jesus wants to change people's perceptions about what he is like and what he stands for, he uses this term, Son of Man. You can read it throughout the Gospel. Son of Man means, listen, I want to change what you think. I want to change what you're going to do. And so we read from Daniel chapter 7, where this phrase, the Son of Man, probably comes from. And it said, "Behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to this Son of Man was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, the one that shall not be destroyed." If ever you wanted a passage that showed us that following Jesus makes us a glory supporter, surely one is here. To Jesus, he is claiming himself that he is this Son of Man. To Jesus will be glory and a kingdom. He'll be given a dominion. He will be given control that all peoples, all nations, all languages should serve him. This is the Jesus that he wants us to see. And yet, just as perhaps the disciples started to get their head round what him being the Son of Man might be apart from the Christ, and there are similar pictures, Christ and Son of Man, Jesus suddenly gives their views, their perceptions, a killer blow. And the trouble is that we don't see this killer blow because we see in hindsight all that happened following Mark chapter 8. We've already seen it in the Bible. But he says in verse 31 of Mark chapter 8, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. This doesn't make sense to the disciples. How can you say, I will be given a dominion, a glory, a kingdom that all peoples will serve me, and then say, I'm going to be killed? That doesn't seem to make sense. And perhaps unsurprisingly, Peter, often the mouthpiece of the disciples, takes Jesus aside and says, don't be silly. Haven't you read your scriptures? This Son of Man, he's not going to be killed. He's going to get the glory. He's going to get the kingdom. And then we see a side of Jesus that we don't often see in our society. When we read about Jesus or see images of Jesus, we see the meek and mild Jesus. Verse 33 is not Jesus meek and mild. Turning to his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan. What must Peter have been thinking at this point? He's just been told, you've spoken the words of God. You've told me you're the Christ that was revealed by God. And then suddenly, get behind me, Satan. And Jesus says, you're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. The disciples had the glory in mind. And Jesus didn't mind that. He didn't deny that he was going to get the glory. But the thing he wanted to change their perceptions to is that their lives and Jesus' lives was not focused right now on the glory, it was focused right now on the suffering. It was to be focused right now on the killing. That was what he wanted to change their perception from the glory to the suffering. The glory would come, but the suffering must come first. In Daniel chapter 7, it says that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. This Son of Man would be served. The Jewish people at the time would be well aware of what serving meant. Slavery. The Roman Empire was built as a foundation upon slavery. Whenever the Romans went in to a country, they would reap a harvest of slaves with them. They would be taken captive. There would be slave markets. The people would be taken. They might have a label put around their necks, and they would be put on a revolving counter so that people could see them, could see their physique. And then you'd be bought if you were a good candidate. There would be a price put on your head, and you will be bought. You'd no longer be your own. Your rights would be extremely limited. You'd have no pay. The work you'd be expected to do, well, you'd be expected to do because you were owned. You were not your own. It was your duty to do the work. You didn't have the right over whether you could marry anymore. You might be allowed to marry, but that was all to the control of your master. You couldn't choose when you got up. You'd be told when to get up. You'd be get up when the master required it of you. You would have to warm the house up before the master got up. You wouldn't choose when to go to bed. You would go to bed when your jobs were done. If there was a party in the house that day, you'd be expected to take the guests home in the dark and the cold to make sure they got home safely. You could only go to bed after everything else had been dealt with. There was no end to your slavery in the normal case. You didn't get to 60 or 65 and the master would then say, brilliant, thanks, you've done your job, off you go. There was no end. There was no retirement. You were a slave till you died, except for one thing. You could be given your freedom if you could pay the money. If you could pay the money that was originally paid for your price, then you could be released. Because that's effectively the debt that you owed. The trouble was, you got no pay. How would you get that money? And generally you couldn't. Once a slave, always a slave. You were stuck there because you couldn't raise the money to free yourself. Except someone else could step in, maybe your family. might step in. Some generous person might come in to free you. And in this case, they will pay the money to your master, and then there will be a ceremony where you'd effectively be given to the gods of the Roman times. You will be now considered to be under the ownership of the gods. And you would be, and the phrase from the Old Testament is, you'd be redeemed. Someone will have bought you. You would be freed. But in Roman terms, you would not be free for yourself. You would now be under the ownership of the gods. Although in practice, this didn't mean very much. The Bible also uses this term redeemed as well. It uses this term redeemed in terms of us as people. The Bible says that we are slaves to sin. We owe a debt to God. God made us, and he set the standards. And he says, if you don't meet my standards, you are slaves. You are slaves to the things that you do wrong. We cannot pay our debt. And yet as Christians we know that God buys us. The New Testament says you have been bought with a price. We have a price on us, and God has bought us. And for us, that should give us great joy as Christians. We have been bought. We have been redeemed. We sang, there is a redeemer. This is fantastic news. We have been freed. Our sins no longer have power over us. But the flip side to having a redeemer is we are now owned. Someone has bought us. We are not our own anymore. We have no rights. We have no rights to say, I'm going to get up at 7 o'clock. We have no right to say, I'll go to bed at 10 o'clock. We have no rights to say, I'm going to get a good night's sleep tonight. We have no right to retire in God's eyes. Being a Christian doesn't end when you're 60 or 70 or 80 or 99 or 100. We don't have a right to say, I'm going to go get married to such and such a person. If we were our own, that would be fine. But we're not our own. We've been bought with a price. We've been redeemed. We don't have any rights anymore. And I found it interesting looking at the advertisements over the past few years that have been on. For example, we looked at L'Oreal. Because I'm worth it. Because I'm worth it. Do we deserve to treat ourselves? Because I'm worth it? Who owns us? What rights do we have? Or we looked at Nike. Just do it. Whatever you want to do, just do it. That's not the way that Jesus wants us to be living. That's not the revolutionary way of thinking he wants to present to us. I found some newspaper articles recently that I found extremely interesting about rights. The world considers itself to have rights. Community Secretary Eric Pickles had declared, "It's a basic human right for every Englishman and woman to be able to put the remnants of their chicken tikka masala in the bin without having to wait 2 weeks for it to be collected." This is talking about when we have our bins collected. It's a basic human right for every Englishman and woman to be able to put the remnants of their chicken tikka masala in the bin without having to wait 2 weeks for it to be collected. Doretta Cox from the Campaign for Weekly Waste Collection said, "It is fundamentally wrong to leave waste for 14 days uncollected." Do we have a right to eat? Is that a basic human right? Is that a basic Christian right? Do we have a right to eat? Can I say, I'm going to have my breakfast now, I'm going to have my lunch, I'm going to have my tea, I'll have second helpings, please. Do we have that right? Do we have the right to waste food? Is that a basic right, human right for every Englishman and woman, that we can waste our food when people are starving around the world? Should it be our mission to set up a campaign for weekly waste collection? I like the story that Martin told me last week of when Billy went up to Cambridge to the people he's now staying with, people from the Salvation Army. And There'd been a man recently on the television, I think it was, Martin said, from the Salvation Army. And so when Martin went up with Billy, he said, "Do you know this man from the Salvation Army that was on the television?" And they said, "Oh yes, we know him, he used to be quite involved. But he went a bit funny," they said. "Because he started customising his uniform." And sometimes as Christians, I think we're a bit like that. We take what is the fundamentals of Christianity, of what God is asking us to do, and we start customising the uniform. We say, "Well, you know, I'm just going to go out to the shops and I'm going to go and buy this." That's okay, isn't it? But is that customising our uniform? "I'm going to go and do this." Is that customising the uniform? Doing things that God really isn't interested in us doing, because he's the master and we're the slave. If we want to know what we're to be doing, we go and ask the master. And when we go and do it, Jesus is claiming he has the right to demand everything of our lives. I don't see in the Bible that there's any claim to anything we have of ourselves that we have a right to. Jesus is saying, "I have the right to demand." When we ask the question, "Who is Jesus?" we say, "Lord." He is the Lord. That's what masters would call their servants. He is the Lord. It's up there. Jesus Christ is Lord. If you ever say, "Jesus Christ is Lord," you are effectively saying, "I have no rights. I am yours. What would you have me to do?" And then Jesus doesn't just leave it there. He doesn't just leave it as, "Who am I?" But he wants to go on to say, "Now what? Now what? What do you need to do now you know who I am? If I am the Lord, what do you need to do about it?" And the answer becomes pretty clear as we read verses 34 to 38. "Like master, like servant." He doesn't just say the following words to his disciples, if you look at it. It's not just this is for the in crowd. He gets everybody there. He gets the whole crowd. And he says to them, "If anyone would come after me, if anyone wants to be my disciple," this is what he says to do, "let him deny himself. Let him take up his cross and then follow me." This is pretty clear stuff. This is not just to the few. This is to anyone who wants to be a disciple. If you come after Jesus, you will deny yourself, you will take up your cross and you will follow. Follow to where? What is Jesus saying to follow to? What has he just been talking about in verse 31? He said, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected and be killed." That's what he's saying to follow to. He's saying, if you're going to follow me, you're going to suffer. When he says, "Take up his cross," what would the Jews be thinking? They'd be thinking in their minds, someone's going to die. They're going to be executed because they're going to walk their cross through the streets just like Jesus would himself. And he's going to be nailed to it, and he's going to die. Jesus says this is what we are to do. Not literally, I don't think. But if we want to be able to call ourselves Christians, if we want to be able to call ourselves disciples, and I include myself in this, if this is what we are going to call ourselves, then our motto needs to be what Jesus has said. Let you deny yourself, take up your cross and follow. Denying yourself means saying no. There are no two ways about it. I will let you know that I struggle with eating too much. I like my food. I've come from a background where I didn't like much food when I was younger. And Mum and Dad would testify to that. I was a terrible eater. And now I've suddenly been awakened to all the wonderful food out there. To olives, to feta cheese. Wheat pasta would be lovely to go with it, and I can't have any of these things much. I find my food wonderful, and this is a great cook to go with it. But in the end, when I want to overeat, there's only one thing I can say to myself that's really going to help. No. I will not. Because there's a times we have to say to ourselves, if Jesus is our master, if Jesus is our Lord, then we say no. No to me. No to what I want. Yes to what you want. We take up our cross. I'm going to die. I'm going to die to myself. Now Jesus is the one I'm living for. That's what Christianity, that's what discipleship is all about. How would we advertise Christianity? I tried to have a think about that. What slogans could we come up with what we like Christianity to be about? Fish for men. Maybe he would say, that's what Jesus said to the disciples. Come and fish for men. That must have sounded quite exciting. Fish for men. Instant healing. That's what we like. We like people to come forward and to be instantly healed. He who has more. Those who don't have less. We like the idea of more. Storm still, period. People like to come to a Christianity that says there's power. And there is power. Freedom calls. We have freedom. Marvelous multiplier. I was beginning to lose faith in my own ideas at this point. I don't think I should go into advertising. Absolute forgiveness. Absolute forgiveness. That's the God that we're coming to. That's what we'd like to advertise it like. But Jesus doesn't advertise it like that way. He would never get onto an advertising board. You don't display a religion to people and say, you're going to die. You're going to die to yourself. No one would be stupid enough to advertise a product and say, you're going to die. That's what Jesus says. The followers he wants are not glory supporters, at least not at the moment. We have our eyes on the glory of heaven, but right now what we need to be saying is, I'm going to deny myself. I'm going to take up my cross and I'm going to follow. Following Jesus is going to have a cost. It's going to have a cost. I wanted to read to you a bit from a book that I picked up. I was quite pleased. It was a bargain at 20 pence. Lord doesn't mean today what it meant when Jesus was here. Back then it meant the maximum authority, the first one, the one above everything else, the owner of all creation. The Greek word kurios, Lord, in small letters, was how slaves addressed their masters. But if the word was capitalized, it referred to only one person in the whole Roman Empire. It was Caesar of Rome. He was the Lord. As a matter of fact, when public employees and soldiers met in the street, they had to say as a greeting, Caesar is the Lord. And the standard response was, yes, the Lord is Caesar. So the Christians had a problem. When they were greeted with Caesar is the Lord, they answered, no, Jesus Christ is Lord. That immediately got them into trouble. Not because Caesar was jealous of the name, it was far deeper than that. Caesar knew that the Christians really meant that they were committed to another authority, and that the balance scale of their lives, Jesus Christ, weighed much more than Caesar. They were saying, Caesar, you can count on us for some things, but when forced to choose, we'll stay with Jesus. Because we've committed our lives to him. He is the first one. He is the Lord, the maximum authority over us. No wonder Caesar persecuted the Christians. Are we suffering because of our loyalty to Jesus? Are we suffering because of our loyalty to Jesus? If we're not, can we claim to be Jesus' disciples? Because Jesus said, that's what needs to happen. He says, for whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. I'm always touched by the story of Jim Elliot. and the other five men that went out as missionaries in Ecuador to reach the Auca Indians. They were at the time a very fierce people, and no white man had ever gone near the tribe and come out alive. But Jim Elliot and his friends, they wanted to reach these people because they knew that Jesus suffered and died for them too. And they were willing to say, if I die, I die. At any cost, God. And yet, when they did die eventually, these five missionaries, at the hands of the Auca Indians, they left behind wives and children. And I was touched when I saw a video recently. It's one of the videos that you can borrow from Gordon's collection out at the front. It was of Marge Saint. This is one of the wives of the men that were left over. This is her testimony as an old woman. And I'm going to show you a video clip of it, of certain key bits. And it was interesting to me that she wouldn't just consider the cost to be when her husband died, because she had another cost to pay as well. Are we willing to pay the cost? Got the sound?
Our hospital actually was just within running distance. I don't say walking distance, because by the time we got off duty, we had to run to get down to the Church of the Open Door downtown Los Angeles. And every Saturday night, there was a real live missionary that told about their work. I had never met a real live missionary. And I remember hearing Ruth Stahl from Peru one time. She told us about her life in Peru, and I said, I was just ready to commit my life for missionary service, but I could never live the life that she's lived. Well, as I look back now, I live more than the life that she lived. We'll always say, ask for those who'd be willing to commit their lives to go to the mission field. And I remember coming down from that third balcony all the way down the steps down to the front, and I told, now this is getting emotional, and I told the Lord that I wanted His will for my life at any cost. And little did I know what that cost would be, but it still hasn't been too much. And even now with cancer for the first time, I still want God's will at any cost. Though this certainly would not have been my choice, neither would it have been to have two husbands die, what seemed to me to be prematurely, but I'm sure it wasn't in God's plan. And then one day, the word came that I had cancer for the fourth time. It wasn't very good news. But then I hearkened back to that night at the Church of the Open Door, and I had said, Your will for my life, Lord, at any cost. This is a cost I really hadn't thought I'd pay, but I'm paying it. I'm paying it willingly. I'm grateful for the good kids, their spouses, and the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. And if I could go back and make that statement again that I made in about 1936, I'd do it again.
That's a lady who got to the end of her life and said, whatever the cost, God asked her to pay, she'd do it again. Are you ready to pay the cost, whatever God asks you to pay? If you're not ready to pay the cost, what needs to change that you will pay the cost? Will you lay it down? Will you lay down the cost? Will you lay down the things that God's saying to you, that's not right? That's not my will for your life. Will you pay the cost? I thought just to finish, I have quite kind of reached my time. I'm just going to play some background music. I put the words up as well, not so that you can sing to it, because you won't know it, I shouldn't have thought, but just so that you can perhaps reflect on the words as they come up. Maybe if you've been touched by something that's been said, you might want to just, as a sign of that, there's some pieces of paper and pencils down at the front here. If you would like perhaps just to write something down on the piece of paper and drop it in the bowl, just writing down, for your own benefit and for God, something that you want to say, God, I want to stop doing that. To show that you are the Lord, and I'm the servant. Something to say, I know you're asking me to do that, and I've been hesitating to do that, but now I'm going to do it. Maybe if that's something you want to do, you could just sort of quietly come forward during the song, just as we finish, and then the service will be over. And if you want to talk through anything or pray through anything, I'll remain here.